Well, I brought the right book, but I didn't bring my glasses.
Oh. Today's session 6, class 2, and we're doing mitzvot 157 through 161, Be'ezrat Hashem. We didn't quite finish last time, so I hope that we've left off at 157, I'm pretty sure. So this mitzvah, the prohibition against eating non-kosher species of fowl, it's interesting, it's a pretty long mitzvah, because it discusses the different signs of fowl. So tell me, if you have heard them ever, what are the signs of kosher and non-kosher fowl?
What they eat is one sign, isn't it? What the bird eats for
predators, right? Predators are not kosher.
Right.
That's correct.
Right. Okay.
Right. So the reason why you're having a hard time is because we don't really have signs.
Okay.
Right. It's not like animals where we know right away.
Right.
There's no Uncle Moishe song about kosher birds. Right. So basically, we have a list in the Torah of the birds that aren't kosher, and everything else is. So that's the way it goes. If you know that list and you know what they are, you can eat everything else. But let's say you don't know that list. So, and you're not that familiar with Torah, so that's why he figured out, or why the sages have figured out certain signs. But the signs are not listed in the Torah. So it's not like the other, it's not like with animals.
You don't know the chewing is cut.
Right, it's not like that at all. So, but there are some signs that once you look at all the kosher species that they share. So one is that they're not predatory. So any predatory bird is not kosher. And then there's three other signs, but they don't have to have them all. Again, it's not like having cloven hooves and chewing your cud. You know, these are different. You could just have one. Even if you have all three, but you're predatory, you're not kosher. So basically it's knowing these.
Kosher.
Pardon?
The vulture.
Correct.
Is not kosher. They probably don't even taste good. You know?
I don't know.
They don't even taste good.
And even if they do.
I haven't either.
I mean, there's non-kosher things that do taste good.
They taste good, right.
So it's not about taste.
No, it's not. But I just meant, you know.
Despite that joke, you know the joke about im ze kasher? Im ze ta'im, ze kasher. Im ze lo ta'im?
It's not tasty.
Kasher le Pesach. So, that is not how we tell, however. That's just a joke,
right.
As you know.
Right.
So, it's a very long mitzvah, and it talks about all different kinds of birds and different signs and different things. If they have a stomach that can be peeled, whatever that means, and if they have back
they have claw. A stomach that can be peeled?
Yeah, whatever that means. I don't know. I don't.
Well, yeah, I've seen the chicken one.
The chicken stomach can be peeled, apparently. Right.
What do you mean peel?
There's apparently a skin, I think, around it.
Yeah.
So you can peel it.
So a stomach that can be peeled is one of the signs. A back claw that's not used for predatory things is another sign. And the gullet, I think. What's that called? Right by the beak in the beginning of the beak, I think it's called a gullet.
I think it is.
Yeah, crop. A crop. Sages of Blessed Memory taught us, this is on page 161, as a general rule that whichever has these three signs in its body, if it has an extra claw, meaning the large claw projecting beyond the other claws, a crop, which is a broad place in the end of the gullet where the bird collects food when it begins to eat, and a gizzard that can be peeled, this being the place where the bird grinds the food, and it's interesting here, we see this occasionally, and here's one of the places where they insert a non-Hebrew word into the Hebrew. So here's, I mean, it's in the English too, called ventri in the foreign language. So la'az is an abbreviation for lashon amzar. And so you'll see that in the commentaries here and there, well, it will say in la'az, the word is. So if Rashi says la'az, he's talking about French. And here, this is written in Spain, so if he says la'az, he's talking about Spanish. But really what it means is lashon amzar, the language of a foreign people. And it's interesting, in Israel, when they talk about the dates, there's the Hebrew date and the lo'azi date. So lo'azi is an adjective made out of the acronym lo'az. Right? Lo'azi means the date belonging to other people. That would be May 9th. Oh, I forgot to change the date at the top of the page, so disregard the dates. I just realized the date's wrong. The class title is correct, but the date is incorrect. I didn't change it. So you'll have to change it. So today's May 9th, and it's the 20th day of the Omer, and it's Dalad Iyar, because tomorrow is Hey Iyar, which is Israeli Independence Day. Anyway, so that the May date is the Loazi date. So here we have a Loazi word, which just is the name of the gizzard. And it says, and just explains, it has a thin skin within the flesh, and that skin can be peeled away in some birds. When a fowl has these three signs, it is known for sure that it's not one of the unclean birds, but is permissible. So the reason why he's giving these rules is just in case you didn't memorize the list. If you have the list memorized and you know that it's not one, and you know enough about birds to know this isn't one of those, if you have those two components inside you, no problem, you can eat anything else. But if you don't, so then if you know these basic principles, then you'll be able to apply them to any bird that you see. So
so squirrel and rabbit are not kosher, right?
That's correct, right, because they're right. Earth critters.
Well, yeah, they're earth critters, right.
Right, so they don't chew their cud or have cloven hooves.
Right. I hadn't thought about that before, because sometimes that's all that's available in life to eat. So I
right.
just
don't
do
get to eat it.
Earth critters? A cow lives on them.
Earth, right. Yeah. That's an earth critter. Mm-hmm. An earth critter.
But you can mm-hmm. eat it.
Right. Right. So I'm just saying, earth critters have two signs.
Yeah.
If you're an earth critter, you have to have split hooves and chew your cud. Squirrels and rabbits don't do that. So as earth critters, they don't meet the criteria, so they're not edible by Jews. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think even if that is all that you can eat, the truth is you can be vegetarian and healthy for quite some time.
Right, right.
So
for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So you can eat rice and beans for
right.
decades and still make it.
Right.
So even if that's the only meat available, too bad, that's
right.
not what we eat.
Right.
Right.
I was just thinking about that with all the frontiersmen and everything, because those were staples, right?
Right, but that's why the Jews were known as egg eaters.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Because that is the protein that they could eat. Yeah, as and that was their name. I think the Indians had a name for Jews, so it was egg eaters, because uh-huh. they knew these people only eat eggs.
But did you have to have an egg from a kosher animal?
Yeah, from a kosher bird. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you identify. So I think a lot of the birds that are around that you could get an egg from pretty easily are kosher.
Kosher, yeah.
Not so easily finding a hawk egg.
Yeah.
Right. So, but there's lots of little, you know. Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I'm not guaranteeing, because I don't know all the signs. I don't know if they're predatory birds
right,
or not.
Another source of the egg. I mean, you see
they're stink pots
eggs,
and,
right.
you know, they're robbers. They rob other birds.
Blue jays?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
They're robbers, yeah.
So maybe they aren't kosher. Who knows?
That doesn't mean that they eat other birds. They're not carrion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they are robbers. They rob the nests. Right. They do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that's this, basically, this one. And I was just interested, on page 165, that top paragraph, it says something that I'm interested in that I didn't yet ask about, but just wanted to show you. So it talks about a few animals that are not kosher, because they're not, and it says, but you don't have to worry about them, they're not found in human settlements. The osprey and the ossifrage. And since they're not found in human habitations, there's no need to have doubts on their account. There are some authorities who said that for our sages of blessed memory, they were not usually found, but now they are quite usual. To them I apply the verse. So it's interesting the reason why I flagged this was because often people bring complaints against Torah-type texts that have incorrect science in them. So here is a text that would say that these are not usually found. And he's pointing out, previous texts have said they're not usually found in human habitation. Mm-hmm. He says, but today they are.
Yeah. Right.
So
yeah, they train osprey, as I remember, mm-hmm. kind of like a hawk-like.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So now it says, what does he say to those people who would say, oh, they are found? To them I apply the verse, do not be overly righteous, from Ecclesiastes 7:16. For they, the sages, said that they are not usually found in human settlement. In other words, They always keep far from the locations of settled communities. Since this is their nature, whether or not it's the reality, but since this is the nature of those birds, the earth abides forever, and the law remains the same at all times. So it goes by the earlier law, whether or not the reason seems like it exists today. It's the same. So it's interesting. I just saw that Kennedy Airport, which is the only airport in the world that employed trained hawks to keep the airspace free, because there's a bird sanctuary right next to Kennedy Airport.
Yes.
And so birds regularly down planes.
Right. They get in the wings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the usual method of keeping airports free of birds is to have snipers and just shoot them out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of them, and a lot of the birds that are around Kennedy Airport are endangered birds or special birds, and they don't want to just shoot them all down. So they employ hawks to keep the airspace clean. Right, and that educates the birds rather than just kills the birds, that this is
a no-flight
zone.
Right.
However, that program was just cut. So it's interesting.
Just what?
Just cut.
Federal cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, federal cutbacks. So it was just cut. Mm-hmm. So the hawkers are also used at some garbage dumps to keep them not free of, but only lightly populated by seagulls. Mm-hmm. They keep hawks flying around to... Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting.
Yeah, here we are in 2011, but they're still like you.
Yeah, they definitely have their function in the world today.
It's a real ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. And it works.
Okay, now 158. Short and yucky. The precept of examining the signs of locusts, if they are kosher. Can you imagine eating bugs? I don't know why these are kosher, and yet they are. So we'll just read it, because it's interesting and short. To examine the terminating marks of grasshoppers, which are the marks written in the Torah, that they have, so here's what's written in the Torah, that they have jointed legs above their feet, etc., in Leviticus 11:21. As it is stated, yet these you may eat of all winged swarming things, of these specific ones. The theme of this root reason is the same as that of any other species of edible creatures, so we talked about that before. Certain ones you can and can't eat. As to its laws, our sages of blessed memory explained that 8 kinds of grasshoppers are kosher, and they are these. The first is called the chagav, the grasshopper. The second is what's called divanit, the hammer locust, a species of chagav. The third is called the chargol, the cricket. The fourth is called ortsavia, the species of chargol. It's a species of chargol. The fifth is arba, the locust. The sixth is the birds of the vineyards. It's a species of arba. The seventh is solam, the bald locust. The eighth is the Jerusalem yohana, which is a species of solam. Whoever is knowledgeable may examine them according to his expert knowledge and their names and eat them. So you have to know the signs and be able to look at each bug, and then you can eat it. An Israelite trapper is trusted about them and about fowl. Whoever has no expert knowledge about them may examine them for the determining marks that the Torah has given for them. So that's two types of things. We could learn the signs. If we know all the signs, then we're not considered experts. Then we can check each one. But let's say we know bugs.
Right.
Right. So then we don't even have to check for the signs, because we know that that one is kosher and that one's not kosher. That's the knowledge it's talking about. If you know the bugs well, then you can right away tell which are the kosher ones and which are the non-kosher ones without having to check each bug out for all of its signs.
And if it's covered in chocolate, you can't tell.
That's why you need a hechsher.
Right.
That rabbis can check them before they're dipped.
Right.
It's amazing to me that they're kosher at all. Right?
Yeah, I'm surprised.
But these are the three distinguishing marks. There are three distinguishing marks, and these are they. 4 wings, which cover most of the length and most of the surface of its body. 4 legs and 2 jointed upper legs with which to leap on the earth. And some say it's necessary to know what its name is, chagav. The rest of its details are clarified in Chapter 3 of the Tractate Chulin. It applies in every place and every time for both man and woman. If a person violates it and eats without examining them well, he disobeys a positive precept. Just so you know, in case you run up against grasshoppers. Okay. Now we're going to start a few different mitzvot on Tuma and Tahara. And hopefully next class, which will not be next week. There's no class next week, so I'll be away. But the following week, is the following week is not yet Memorial Day, right? I think we're on the following week.
The 22nd of May, which is a Sunday, so it'd be the 23rd, I think, would be the week after. May 23rd.
Because we're missing the 16th, which is Barbara Sonnen's 50th birthday.
7 days would be the 23rd.
Who's birthday?
Barbara Sonnen is turning 50.
Wow.
Next Monday.
Oh, wow.
So we're missing that one, and then the following one, I want to do a class on Tuma and Tahara, the concepts of Tuma and Tahara.
Okay.
So so we're going to start just looking at drop, but a conceptual class on Tuma and Tahara.
Very misunderstood.
Very misunderstood. And we're very just undereducated. Forget right. Misunderstood. I'm not even talking about mikvah stuff. I'm talking about Tuma and Tahara all in general. Yeah. Yeah, so here we start with that, okay? So this is about mitzvat tum'at shmona shratzim. So this is the mitzvah of the tuma of eight different kinds of crawling creatures. So first of all, let me ask you, what sounds weird about the title of this mitzvah? The mitzvah is called The Ritual Uncleanliness of Eight Low Crawling Creatures.
Well, because most of them are, we consider, unkosher. So here they're listing just eight?
Not unkosher. This is not about unkosher. This is about the tuma of those creatures.
Oh, the tuma. Okay, sorry.
The tuma of them.
Right.
So what's strange about this mitzvah so far? We're just looking at the name of it.
The word uncleanliness just jumps out at me.
It's uncleanness, which when I typed in uncleanliness, because that's what I read too, I got the red line on the computer, and then I checked here just to make sure that, because I was going to put it in my dictionary, checked to make sure it was spelled right, and then I see it's actually uncleanness. It's not uncleanliness, so it's a ritual uncleanness. That happened to be in my spell check.
There's no such word, uncleanliness?
I guess not. I mean, not according to spell check. But uncleanness worked. That's not it. There's no action in this mitzvah. Right?
Oh, it's just a statement.
It's a statement. So how could this be a mitzvah?
Okay.
A mitzvah is something you're supposed to do or not do, right? So this is just weird. How is this a mitzvah? So this is actually a machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Ramban saying this is not a mitzvah, and it makes a whole case for why it's not a mitzvah. And the author actually agrees with the Ramban, except for he made a commitment at the beginning of writing this book that he's going by the Rambam. Mm-hmm. And so since he's going by the Rambam, he's enumerating as one of the mitzvot. But he also does not really understand why this is considered a mitzvah rather than just an explanatory concept. So here's the mitzvah. That eight low-crawling creatures are considered tameh and cause tuma, as it is stated. And these are what are unclean to you among the low-crawling things that move upon the earth. And so it doesn't give you the whole list here. It does give you the whole list in the pasuk. And it's not considered just creepy things. It's included in this list is the weasel, the mouse, the lizard, and five other things. Right, and these are called shratzim, sherets, a sherets, okay? So sherets is a category of creepy thing. And in this case, probably creepy thing means both physically that it creeps and also, you know, about the back of your neck that it's creepy, right? That it's a creepy thing. So whether it's, I mean, the weasel doesn't seem as creepy, although it creeps. And I think that's the biggest one of these. A weasel's pretty big.
Yeah, they could be.
Mm-hmm. But they're considered tameh. So what lies at the root of this precept? Let's start with a preface. So this is a fascinating concept here. It goes quite a length, saying, we actually can't understand. We don't really know. It's not that we can understand every concept and every mitzvah and every Torah truth. It's not within our ability to understand. Moshe didn't understand them all. Shlomo didn't understand them all. We certainly can't understand them all. And so this is one that's kind of outside of our understanding. That being said, there's something we could look at. So, and it's interesting, he brings a phrase. Where did it go? That's not in English. We don't use this phrase. But it's just interesting to look at. Anyway, it's the last paragraph on page 169. Now that he said he can't really explain it, he's going to explain something. But he doesn't want this. Now, Let not some eager questioner think to attack me with the metaphor that the sages of blessed memory used. The spoon that the carpenter carved out, with that let him burn his mouth with mustard. Meaning, you made your bed, now lie in it, right? So he's saying, I just said you can't understand it, but I'm just about to explain something, so don't bring this phrase up against me, that I just carved something and now I should be burnt by it. Because still we can understand something. It says, yet I have raised my hand to speak a word about them to my young folk. For long ago did our sages precede me to relate many things about them in the Midrashim and elsewhere by the way of their plain meaning. And their deep wisdom, mighty understanding, and great holiness are hidden within them. Not even all the winds will budge them. So these concepts are very deep. We're just going to learn, like at the tip of the iceberg, we should know that there's an iceberg underneath. However, knowing that, even if you tip the touch, that if you touch the tip of the iceberg, you are touching the iceberg, right? So even if you can only see the tiny little bit on top, still by learning that little bit, you are touching, even if you don't understand it, even if you don't comprehend it, even if you don't see the whole thing, you are still coming into contact with the deeper levels of the mysteries. So you should know that by learning this, we are coming into contact with some of the mysteries of spirituality. Even if they don't go into our conscious mind, but they go into our subconscious, it still touches our neshama. Okay, then if anyone delves to find deep counsel in their plain explanation and strives to show something new in their overt meanings because he yearns to gain a glimpse through the lattice in order to find delight in the radiance of their vision, and he yearns to gather of their leaves in order to gird himself with them, it is not proper to put blame on him for this, but rather to bless him and to mention him for praise at his level.
Very sweet.
Right?
That's very sweet the way he says that. Right.
Okay. Yeah. So,
so don't blame me when I like to delve into a little bit of the Kabbalah.
Right.
Yes. Right.
You could delve. Yes, that's what he's saying. Right. Right. So he's just looking a little bit.
Through the lattice and getting a little peek.
Right. But he's not even saying deep stuff here. He's basically saying you just have to understand that Hashem only commands that which is good. So you have to know that that's the basic premise here, is that every single commandment is for our best. So, and it's interesting. I was just speaking to somebody yesterday about organ donation. So this person said that they believe in organ donation and they believe that saving a life overrides everything. And so they are a complete organ donor and they don't believe. I said, well, you know, you could be a halachic organ donor. There's a halachic organ donor society. So that person said, nope. He said, I feel like my feelings trump halacha. I think the halacha is wrong here. I think that, you know, if you can save a life, that's more important. And so the halacha doesn't allow you to give your heart because it has to stop beating first. And so, but I believe if somebody's life could be saved, if I'm in a vegetative state and somebody's life could be saved by my heart, I think they should take it. I said, well, then you don't really understand halacha. You just don't understand the purpose of halacha if you think you can just override it. Even when halacha might be, it may have been decided incorrectly in some places, which it may be, it's possible still. The concept of halacha is that it guides us to the overall good. So, yes, we override halacha. We override certain important principles like Shabbos. In order to save a life, but we don't override murder in order to save a life. And it would be considered murder. You have to understand what's the greatest good that you're trying to achieve. If you think that saving a life is a good that's greater than you being alive at the end of your life, even in a vegetative state, then you just don't understand the way the world works. So halacha is there to define the ultimate good. And yes, it's true. Occasionally there may be little areas that were decided in error. But in general, you can be safe inside the system. That what you're doing is bringing you to the ultimate good, and refraining from those things will protect you from negativity. So that's what he's saying here. All this is for the good. We don't really understand what the good is.
He should have quoted Shoftim, my favorite, you know, in there. 17, 8 through 12 or 8 through 13.
Which says, because which, not everybody recognizes
what
that.
What is that?
which is the story of the rabbis have a little different take on this, but I'll tell you what Hashem showed me in it. It's where the rebellious elder, it's the story of him, where he was not taking the word of the courts on a decision. And Hashem lays it out to Moshe, and then Moshe repeats it, that it doesn't matter. Whatever the courts say, they have the authority. So if they say, this isn't an exact quote, but if they say left is right and right is left, you follow it.
So
he gave them, and it says, for go to the judges in that time that you have the question. So it's kind of like everybody was at Mount Sinai type thing, whether they were physically there or not. Whenever the question arises, you will have a legal court system, and that's who you are to go to and to follow.
So how could it be that your take is different than the take of the rabbis if the entire thing is about following the take of the rabbis?
I don't know. I mean, they've never said it was wrong, because I was searching for, because my opinion was always that, like for a pastor or a priest or whatever, they put their pants on one leg at a time like anybody else. So they can be wrong, so I can decide for myself if it appears to me that through all of the proofs and everything that they're incorrect. So for me to give the authority over to a rabbi,
right,
which I had to do before I could convert, if I couldn't do that, then stay home. Type thing. So one day, I probably read those verses a dozen times, but one day it popped out at me that the rabbis were given the authorities to make those decisions. And whether they're making a mistake or not making a mistake. Now, if it's to kill somebody and you know, but the basic judgment is theirs to give. There will be a court, and you go to the court in the day that you have the question. There will always be a court for you who are trying to observe halakha.
So, and you understand it differently than that?
No, that's my understanding.
And the rabbis understand differently than that?
What I was told by my dear Rav was, well, there's a little more to it than that. I said, I'm sure there is. But the Peshat came through to me pretty strong in applying that.
That was a message that you took out.
A message
right.
to me.
And so you
the message
to...
is not wrong. I'm sorry.
Right, yeah.
But there's more to it than that. Oh, I'm sure there is.
Right.
But that's, you can walk away with that. That's
one piece of
it. Yeah, because it goes into, it says basically that if, you know, they say the grass is green but it's blue.
Yeah, you know it's green.
Okay, Rabbi, I'll follow it. I don't agree with you, but okay.
Right. All right, so here is the one level of depth he gives. After saying that we can't really understand it and that we don't really know, but we do understand that uncleanliness, which is tuma, will be harmful to the soul. Tuma is bad for your neshama. So there is a little grammatical twist that's used to help explain this, and that is where it says in Leviticus 11:43, as it is written, vinitmetem bam, that you should be defiled by them, that these things cause tuma. It's written without the aleph. Tame has an aleph in it. So it could be read vinitamtem bam, which means you will become stupid through them. So there is an inyan of spiritual defilement that leads to whatever the intellect is called. Is it physical? I think it is physical, technically, our brains and how it processes things. So you have a spiritual defilement that leads to a physical stupidity. So that we have, there is a timtum. So we talked about earlier, the timtum halev that's caused by eating non-kosher foods. But this is about, not by non-kosher, but by about tuma. So there's a timtum that's caused by tuma.
Timtum is stupid.
It's stupid. Callousness. There's all different words, but so it's not related to tapesh. Timtum halev is it's an intellectual. What's the right word? I guess a veiling of the intellect, because it is a thickening. It's considered like something that covers the heart. Timtum halev. Also, timtum halev comes from non-kosher foods. This is the intellect that's affected.
Maybe that's different. Maybe is that in Isaiah where he talks about the heart being circumcised and that...
I think that's for kosher foods. This is for tumah.
Okay.
A separate thing. And that's it says here that you'll be made... And this is just from coming into contact with it. Just touching it, right, causes this tumah. That is to say that the wellsprings of intelligence, which is the soul that endures, become somewhat impaired by the matter of defilement. So, nor should you wonder that the intelligence can be impaired by physical matters, even if they're not of its kind, because the soul is united with the body. This can happen to it beyond any doubt. And if we human beings, with our meager understanding, do not know the soul and its nature, how can we seek to the point of exhaustion to know what heals or sickens it? By way of probing investigation. So, you know, he is at a time of science. He's writing in Spain during the golden age of Spain. So there was some science among the Muslims at the time. Mm-hmm. Of course, not the science that we have today, but still there was some scientific investigation. But this is actually before they were really looking into bodies and how bodies actually work. But still, even physicians find no plan of healing until they discern the core of the illness. So they're saying, if you don't understand how the soul works, how can you possibly say that this will benefit or this will hurt it? You don't know, because you don't know how the soul works. Mm-hmm. Even the physician on the physical level has to understand how the body works somewhat in order to be able to say, this is what's causing the problem, this is how we're going to fix the problem. So he's saying, you have to trust Hashem, who does understand how the soul works. These things hurt the soul. And then he's saying also, so that's one principle, these things hurt the soul. And the second principle is body and soul is connected. Because you'd have to wonder, well, how does touching something, a physical action, harm your soul, a spiritual entity? But body and soul are connected, so that things that you do physically have an impact on your soul. That's the whole concept of mitzvot.
Kosher. That's why you kosher.
Right, but that's the whole concept of mitzvot altogether. Everything that you do physically has an impact on your soul, spiritually. Right. That's what a mitzvah is, a physical pathway to a spiritual result. That's what all physical behavior is, right? So mitzvot are just prescribed and proscribed behaviors that will have positive and or negative effect on your soul. So you need to figure out what to do in order to engage in the physical in ways that help your spiritual. And just one more paragraph that we can't really understand. Know and understand it, for thereby we will find some slight answer about all the root reasons for the precepts of Tumah and Tahara, until there will be almost a mask of equanimity on our faces concerning the novelty of the precept of the red heifer. So that you could understand, you could try to figure out, right, all the things that are Tumah and Tahara, and still you're going to be completely confused by this one, the red heifer, because the red heifer both defiles the ritually clean and purifies the ritually unclean.
Right.
It's just like such a paradox in one beast, right? But thereto we will continue at length about the subject and receive reward for toiling to find words of delight later on when we look at that mitzvah, which is 397, so we're not going to get to it for a while. Okay, so this just talks about the different laws of these animals then. So some of them, let's see, they all convey tumah when you touch them. Let's see, but they have to be dead. So if they're alive, it's not, but it's only if it's dead, and these eight creatures, and if you touch them, and it's not even other creatures that may be like them, it's not about snakes, and it's not about other swarming creatures or scorpions that don't cause any tumah at all. It's these specific eight, once they're dead, that cause tumah. If you touch them, it makes the clothes that you touch become, that you're wearing, become tumah. And if they fall into a vessel, that vessel becomes tumah. Depending on what the vessel is made out of, it can become irreparably tumah, and then it has to be broken. Can't ever be used again. So it has all kinds of laws about it. So hopefully we'll go more deeply into it. But there's all kinds of stuff. And it's only the amount that can be metameh of these things is the amount of a lentil. So it's a tiny little bit. It's even smaller. We'll see. And with kosher animals in Nevela, that's the amount is the amount of an olive. Here it's the amount of a lentil, a tiny little bit. And it can even be bound together. So let's say you have an eyelash and half a toenail and a couple of hairs. So it all comes together to make the size of a lentil. That counts. As long as it's all together.
And that amount makes your tummy.
Yeah. Yeah. once it's dead, that tiny little bit. And then the way that you get out of that tuma is by going to the mikvah. So, and waiting till the night time, I'm pretty sure. Or is that the tame animals? Well, anyway, it says that we don't have to worry about these today because we don't have tuma and tahara. But still...
I was going to just ask you that.
Right.
Are we able?
Right. We do still have...
tuma right. position in life.
So here's the thing. We do still have tuma and tahara today.
Right.
And it does still affect us.
Aren't we all tuma?
We're all tame mate.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other kinds of tuma too. So what do we do about that?
Tuma and tuma. You don't want tuma and tuma.
Right. So you don't want too much tuma.
Right.
Okay. We don't have a reason that we... So we don't have, in a way, a deadline to get rid of this tuma, but we still might have a reason to get rid of the tuma. So the deadline would be that we have something to do in the Beit Mikdash, or we have truma to eat for a kohen, right? So you can't eat truma with this kind of tuma. You know, that's tithe, that's just for the kohenim that has to be eaten in tahara. You can't eat that. So let's say it's supper time and you're supposed to eat truma, so you have to take care of your tuma. Right, so we don't have that today. And we don't have going to the temple, and we don't have all kinds of other services that you have to be tame, tuma free in order to do. That being said, however, it still does affect our neshama.
Right.
Which is why men go to the mikvah, and some men go to the mikvah on a somewhat regular basis, because they do want to take off whatever tuma they can. Because it does make a difference. It's interesting, because we don't see that women are nohig to do that, nohagot to do that. It's not their custom to go to the mikvah. Even a single, even an elderly, even a unencumbered woman, we don't see that that's common in our community, meaning our worldwide throughout the generations community, our Jewish community. We don't see that it's a thing for women to go to the mikvah except for Erev Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah and for Nida. So, and I'm not sure what that is. So I would imagine that that means that it's a stringency and an extra thing for those men who go. The only one who has to go, men who have to go, are scribes. Oh, scribes, in order to write.
Have a Kohen, yeah.
No, a Kohen doesn't have to go today.
Okay.
There's not, as far as I know. Yeah. But a scribe, when he comes to, when he's writing the Shem Hashem, he can write the rest.
Oh, wow.
But for Shem Hashem, he has to go to the mikvah first. So, and I don't think it's, now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think it's necessary. I think it's a custom. For scribes, I think it's necessary. I think you have to. But for Shochtim, I know that just from our association with Ilan, that the plants that he built had to have mikvahs in them. Because the Shochtim who came from Eretz Israel required a mikvah, and they went to the mikvah every morning. Now, is that because they're Hasidim and they just didn't want to be in a place without a mikvah, and they go every day and that's part of their life? Or is it about the Shechita? I don't know. But I know that he had to build mikvahs near his plants. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, 160. The precept of the ritual uncleanliness of food. Again, one of those mitzvot without a behavior. So this is one that the Ramban would say is not a mitzvah. That we are commanded to observe the ritual uncleanliness of solid and liquid food, and to behave in the matter according to the Torah, which informed us how to decide every question of tuma, of food and drink, and of the vessels through which they become tameh, as it is stated, all food in which may be eaten, on which water comes, shall be unclean. So, we're going to go into it much more next time. There's all kinds of, there's 7 liquids that convey tuma. Let's see if I can remember most of them. Water, blood, urine, tears. I don't know if mucus does or not. Urine does.
Saliva.
Right, and I'm not sure about saliva. Maybe saliva does too. Right. There's 7 liquids that can transfer tuma. So that's, water's one of them. So at the Seder, we dip our vegetable, right? But before we do that, before we dip it in salt water, because that's a liquid that can transfer tuma, and our hands have tuma on them, We wash our hands.
We have a ritual washing. That's what the washing is without
the blessing. Without the bracha.
Right.
That's correct. So it is reminiscent of the Beit HaMikdash. If we were living totally free, totally in the times of spiritual positivity with the Beit HaMikdash in place, we would always wash before we ate something wet. So there are a few people today, it's not common, but there are some who will wash before they eat wet, especially wet grapes, but wet fruit. That's one group of people. And then wet fruit of the land of Israel, so just narrowing it down to wet grapes. That's usually what you would eat wet. Usually raisins or dates or pomegranates. We don't eat wet.
You don't say bracha on the washing.
No, you don't say bracha on the washing. Okay. But since water transfers tumah, and since those fruits are special, so some people will wash. So why do we do that? Really, only the washing is only reminiscent of the Beit HaMikdash. And that's why we wash our hands for bread, too. It's fascinating. Washing our hands for bread today is a placeholder for Kohanim. It is not about our obligation, because really in temple times we wouldn't be washing for bread. We wash for bread today because we want to keep the laws of Tumah and Tahara alive in the Jewish people. So we all are taking place in keeping Tumah and Tahara consciousness alive, because it doesn't really matter today. Except for it does matter. It doesn't matter in terms of the Tumah and Tahara. What matters is in terms of keeping Tumah and Tahara consciousness. Tumah and Tahara consciousness, the concepts of Tumah and Tahara are so deep and so important that it's vital that we keep a thread of it alive even in non-temple times. So all of us around the world wash our hands before we eat bread every time to keep the consciousness of Tumah and Tahara alive, so that when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt, we haven't dropped the ball. But there's going to be so much more that comes, because this is just the tiniest little thread. But at least that's part of our daily practice. You know, it's part of the consciousness of Am Yisrael, that there is Tumah and Tahara and that we wash to take care of it. So that's kept alive. There are those people, though, who want to keep it more alive for themselves, even. And so they're careful with wet fruits. When they eat something that's just, look, if you just rinse an apple, so some people will dry it first before they eat it and make sure their hands are dry. Or they'll wash. They're going to eat it wet, so they wash their hands for that reason, to take the tumah off their hands, because water transfers tumah. So the getting to know Hashem includes, and this was emphasized to me again and again in Israel this time, and I was learning with my friend and teacher, Katriel Sugarman. He said, Aliza, if you want to learn the Ratzon Hashem, learn the laws of Tumah and Tahara.
That'll tell you.
Yeah. So, and we think of it as so esoteric, and it is so esoteric for us today. But it's got very deep things in it. So hopefully next time we'll learn a little bit more about it. Okay, so ritual uncleanliness of food. So how it becomes uncleanly or not. And it talks all about the water that comes in contact with it, if it does and if it doesn't, and when it can become tamei and when it can't. So if it's still growing in the ground, or if it's still not ready food, it can't yet be makabel tumah. So that means to receive tumah. So even if a pear is still on a tree, it's not yet considered food until you pick it. Right? So as long as it's still connected to whatever it grew from, even by a tiny little thread, it's not considered food until you take it as food, until the human interacts with it. Then it's just still a part of the plant. But once the human interacts with it and takes it as food, it becomes food. But it's not yet considered food until it's been washed either. So it can't be makabel tumah, because human beings wash food. We don't eat. It's not our custom to eat. So he talks about vegetables, certainly potatoes, things like that. It's not our custom to eat it until we've washed it. So, but you might eat a pear right off a tree without washing it. That could be clean enough. But because it's part of the group of things that grow, then in most of the things from that group, meaning all fruits and vegetables, most of those things we wash before we eat. So even those things that we don't have to wash before we eat, we consider that they have to be, not that they have to be washed, but that they won't receive tumah until it's washed, until it's been fully taken into the human domain for food. So that includes the washing. So then this goes into how things are taken into the human domain and the washing and what that means. And it even mentions challah. It has to be ready to be eaten. So the washing makes it ready to be eaten. So challah too. You can't take challah from the flour that you're about to make dough from. Right? There's the right time to take challah. So when you're separating out that portion of dough that's going to be given to the Kohen, it has to be ready dough. It can't be ingredients. So separating from the flour is taking ingredients. It's not dough.
Okay.
And if the dough hasn't been kneaded properly, even if you've mixed it mostly, but it's not kneaded all the way, or it's not ready dough, then you can't take challah from it yet. It has to be ready food. So once it's been kneaded, and it's been made into its proper dough, that's when you can take challah. I personally take challah after it's risen. I don't know, do you have a custom to take it?
That's what I do.
Yeah, after it's risen. Because I think, and I'm not sure why that is.
It's ready to bake.
Because I think then it is ready dough. Because I think maybe it's not.
That's
right, that does seem to be the custom. You take it before you shape it, right? You don't just take it. It's interesting, we don't take it right after. So I'm, again, not positive for that halacha.
I don't know if you could or not, I don't know.
Right, yeah, I'm not positive of that halacha. It seems to be the custom that we take it after it's risen, before we shape it, rather than after we've kneaded it, before we let it rise. Right, so that seems to be the time. So, but here it's saying, just so we don't learn halacha lamaaseh from this, but it's just interesting. So challah, whose time is to be given is not until the flour is kneaded well into a round dough. And this is why if someone separates challah as flour, it's not challah. That's interesting how he says what it is. It's not challah, but the product of robbery in the hands of the Kohen.
Isn't that something? Until it's
needs to be made into the dough first, and then it's challah.
And then it says, and the Kohen must give it back. You know this here.
Oh, the Kohen has to give it back. It's not proper challah.
Right.
Right, it's not challah. Right. It did not work. Right. All right, so that's what it's saying, the product of robbery. So if you will give the
flour.
What if you
went ahead then,
and give it to him?
That's when you took it, but you went ahead and fixed it and baked it. My impression was that if that is found out, then the Kohen must give it back.
No, it's not dough. You're giving the Kohen a measure of flour. If the Kohen accepts it, then he's robbing from you because he's not entitled to it. He's entitled to.
I see. Okay.
But flour,
right,
he's not.
Right.
This flour, he's not. There may be other flours.
What if you took it from the flour, not knowing, and then you went ahead and you did your preparation, and you baked it, and you gave it to the Kohen?
No.
I'm just saying, what if you did?
It doesn't matter because the flour is nothing that you took from. Yeah, the whole thing is giving the ready dough to the Kohen.
To be, but that's why he's explaining that it can't come from any of the parts. It has to come from the whole.
Right, but even if you took it from the part and then you finished baking it and then you gave it to the Kohen, he could eat that because then you did it right.
But it would not be the giving, it wouldn't be the proper giving to the Kohen. Because you did not take. Well, I see what you're saying. Because
once you give it to the Kohen as a ready loaf,
is
it's
that
done,
piece,
right?
So he couldn't even eat that flour because it's just flour that you're giving him that you took for his portion.
Even if he would make that flour into pancakes and he could eat that flour, he's not entitled to it.
Okay.
That's why it says it would be his theft.
Okay.
He doesn't get that flour.
Gotcha.
It's not challah.
Right.
So he's not entitled to that flour. So.
Right.
He shouldn't take it.
And the word challah means?
Challah means the portion of dough that's separated from your big dough that belongs to the Kohen.
So what does that word mean? Portion or separation or?
No, challah doesn't mean.
No. It probably means,
it's
it probably
just a
comes.
A title?
Probably comes from, no, it can't be just a title.
Okay. I know.
It probably comes from the word fall upon, like chal.
Oh.
So we use that word, chal, like we'll say Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos this year, right? You know how you use that word falls on?
Mm-hmm.
That word in Hebrew is chal.
Okay.
Yom Kippur chal b'Shabbat Hashanah.
So this is the portion that falls on the Kohen.
No, this is the halacha falls on this part, right. I think. Chala.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
Makes sense, but that's a good question. Why is that called the challah? I think it's because it falls, it's hal on that.
Okay.
I have to ask. That's a good question. That seems to make sense to me. Okay. I want to finish this. All right. Oh, we're almost there. Good. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention Afatuma and Vladatuma, so I just want to mention those two those two words for you, and then we'll do 161, so we will be able to finish today. Just to introduce these concepts, and we're going to get to them again, but I want you to hear it because you have to hear it a few times. So Avhatuma, we have this concept of Av and Vlad or Toledot throughout Halacha, right? So we have Av Malachas on Shabbos. Everybody's familiar with that term. Right, 39 major categories of work from which we must refrain, and each one of them has their children. Mm-hmm. That's called an Av Malacha, and then there's Toledot, the generations. So here we have Av Hatuma and Vlad. Vlad means fetus, or is it always a fetus, or could it be a baby? I think it's a fetus. But it means that which comes from the. It's related to the word nolad, yelad, too. It comes out from the father.
So, born.
Leva, what is born? A Vlad is born?
No,
oh, Nolad. Nolad is born, correct. Yeah. Nolad. Right, it's all the same root. Right. Correct. So it means comes out from. So Av HaTumah is the major category of Tumah, and then there are things that are Tame underneath it, some of which can be contagious, some of which are not. So, for instance, the most tame thing is called, even though there's other things that are called avatumas, which we'll see, but the most tame thing, the thing that is called the avatuma, is, you know, a dead Jewish body. Mm-hmm. A dead Jewish body is the most tame thing there can be. More tame than a dead non-Jewish body. So that's the avatuma, and that Tuma is contagious, so that even by standing under the same roof, let alone touching, for sure if you touch it, you become Tame. Anything that it touches becomes Tame. But even standing under the same roof as a dead Jewish body would confer Tuma, a level of Tuma, on that person. And then the question is, so then that person is not considered Av HaTumah. You don't get the same level. It comes down. There's a Vlad HaTumah. So that person, that alive person who has the Tumah from the mate, from the dead body, now they go into a different building, right? And there's a roof over them and somebody who's not Tameh mate. Their Tumat mate doesn't transfer to the other person. That's a Vlad HaTumah, not Av HaTumah. So Av HaTumah can transfer Tumah. So that's why I said, don't worry about this. I just wanted to introduce these terms.
Does not transfer.
Something that comes out. No, 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 don't say that. Don't write that.
Oh, okay. I thought that's what you said.
It is what I said, but don't write that yet. Don't make that a definition.
Okay.
I just want to introduce these words.
Yeah, it's,
Av HaTumah,
it's just a thought, though, that
right.
with it.
Yeah. Av HaTumah is the major category of Tumah, and Vlad is the derivative category.
So you're not totally in contact with the dead body.
So whatever it is, I'm just giving an example of the dead body being the most tame thing. We're going to go into this again. I just want to introduce these two vocabulary words. Avatuma, the most tame thing that can transfer tuma. Vlad is something that is born from the avatuma. So we'll get back to that. That has to do with in the ritual uncleanliness of those eight low crawling creatures. He talks about those things and how they're metame things, how they cause tuma on things. We'll look at it again when we have our class in Tuma and Tara. Okay. 161. The precept of the ritual uncleanliness of animal carcasses. Okay, so this is the tuma of animals that are that died without ritual slaying. So a nevela, meaning a kosher animal, an animal that could be kosher, one of those four categories of animals that died without ritual slaying, is ritually unclean and causes tumah. For it is stated, if any animal which you may eat dies. So it's an animal that you can eat from, but it dies not according to shechita, then the carcass is tameh. So, for instance, that's one reason why we wash our hands after we touch our shoes. Right, our shoes are made of leather, of a kosher animal, but not necessarily shechted. I don't know what the halacha would be if we would know for sure that our shoes are made from a shechted animal's carcass. You know, like in the olden days when, you know, peddlers came through us, a shoemaker would come to your farm. So if it was in the land of Israel and it was, you know, you knew those that leather was from the neighboring farm where they shecht sheep and cows, so that was shechted leather. Maybe you don't have to wash after you touch it, because it's not tummy, but it is tummy if it wasn't shechted. Let's see. Rambam of blessed memory wrote about this precept in these words. Now here I will relate to you a preface suitable for you, which you should remember in regard to everything we mention about the kinds of tumah. This is that when we list every single kind of tumah as a positive precept, its sense is not that we should be obligated to become defiled by that ritual defilement, and equally we need not avoid becoming defiled by it, so that it should constitute a negative precept. So he's Rambam is now addressing, how is this a precept without a behavior? Right? So he's saying, it's not, there's a whole category of stuff that we're discussing here, and you shouldn't think that you have to become tummy by it, or that you shouldn't become tummy by it. It's just that you do. The truth is that when the Torah states that whoever comes in contact with this particular sort becomes tummy, or that thing is mitame, defiles in such a manner, whatever comes in contact with it, it is a positive precept. So this is considered one of the mitzvot asay, even though there's nothing to do here. In other words, this law, which is thereby ordained, is a precept, which, as we said, is that whoever comes in contact with this in such a manner becomes defiled, and whoever does not in such a manner is not defiled. As for the very matter of becoming defiled, every man has the free right to choose if he wishes to become ritually unclean or not. So this mitzvah is just that you should know that this is how you become tamei and how you avoid becoming tamei. That's the mitzvah. Not that you should or that you shouldn't. Everybody gets to pick. That's not the mitzvah, right? You get to pick if you want to become tamei or not. If you want to touch that thing or not. If you like to do leather work, you're allowed to touch it, even though it makes you tamei. It's not that you shouldn't. It's just that it does. That's the mitzvah, knowing that it does. I might think that if a man touched their carcass, he should receive 40 lashes with a whip, right? That he shouldn't be. Scripture states, and by these you shall become unclean, and nothing more, meaning you become tummy, but you don't get punished for it.
Right.
Then I might think that if a man saw a carcass, he should go and be defiled by it, so maybe he should become tummy. Scripture states, and their carcasses you shall not touch. Then how is this to be understood? You might say that it's free choice. You must say that it's free choice. It's interesting. Because you might think that it says those carcasses you shall not touch means you're not allowed to touch them. Thus, the precept is what we are told about these laws, that whoever comes close to this becomes defiled and is ritually unclean. And he becomes obligated in the duties of the ritually unclean to go out of the camp of the Shekhinah, that he should not eat sacred food, nor go close to it, and so forth. This, then, is the precept. In other words, that he would be defiled by this sort when he comes in contact with it, or when it is with him in such a manner. Remember this point about every single one of the various kinds of ritual uncleanliness. And that's what he says. Mm-hmm. So he says it's not usur to become tummy. You just do.
You do.
So, and then, but you have to know the halachas of it once you become tummy, so mm-hmm. you can't touch certain foods, and you can't go certain places, and you can't do certain things. You have to know that. Those would be usur to do. But actually being tummy is not usur.
Okay,
I think that's what we're going to stop with today. Right, so I'll just finish this mitzvah, just one more thought about it. So that any animal that is edible by Jews, if we kill it according to Shechita, the carcass is not tamei. If we don't kill it according to Shechita, then it is tamei. Let's say we make a mistake. Right, so I thought this is fascinating. So let's say you're in the temple. You're shechting a sheep. And you blow it with the shechita. You make the knife go too far, you nick a bone or whatever, and now the animal's not kosher, right? But now it's in the Beit HaMikdash. Not a lot. So, and it's tummy, right? Because it wasn't shechted properly. What do you do? So it's interesting, because I was wondering as I'm reading this, that there's a little clause here. They're not tummy until they're all the way dead. So... they can't cause tumma while they're still thrashing about in their death throes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in the 183, just at the bottom of the second paragraph. So that if you realize you blew the shechita, you quickly gather the animal up and get him out of the Beit HaMikdash right away. Because while it's still thrashing around, it can't make things tummy.
Hmm.
until it's completely dead. So there's that little pause. You have that little grace period in between the cut and the full death. So it's interesting. And I wonder how that grace period applies to other things in halacha. I don't know the answer, but it is a question. Like, you know, where if it applies here, it must apply somewhere else, that there's something in between the cut and full death. So we'll just leave it as a question, because I don't know the answer to that. And hopefully we'll continue learning. So in 2 weeks, we're going to have a class on Tuma and Tahara.
Where are you going?
And I'm going this week to the WIC conference, Women in Kiruv.